Is our country fit for world leadership? In a real sense, our America has not solicited this role of world leadership. Leadership may be looked upon by many as a crown, but it is really a crown of thorns. Leadership on the part of a great country does not make the citizens of it, the individual citizens of that country, any happier or any more secure. Some years ago, in looking through a volume of history, I chanced upon a very interesting cartoon which was made in Great Britain at the time of the Jubilee celebration of Queen Victoria. The cartoon in its way represented all the pomp and majesty of the far-flung British Empire, upon which in those days the sun never set. And it showed the dignitaries and the chieftains and the rulers of the many countries which belonged to the British Empire, and the leaders of their armies marching down in one great procession in the city of London, in celebration of the Jubilee of Queen Victoria. And on the curb, watching this majestic procession, was a shabbily dressed, discharged soldier leaning on a crutch and saying to a poor woman, shabbily dressed with her equally poorly dressed children, clinging to her skirt, as it were, saying these words, "What has all this done for us?" Leadership, even when it does not take the form of great empire building, exacts a very high price of such a leading people in terms, first, of maintaining a very costly military establishment, our world being what it is, exacting a high price in terms of waging wars to maintain what it regards as the world order of which it approves, and exacts a high price in terms of supporting the economy of many nations whose solvency is vital to the strategy of leadership of this leading nation. Smaller nations who are not burdened with the responsibility of world leadership, of directing and supervising world affairs, smaller nations actually may be happier nations. Citizens may lead quieter and more relaxed lives. That is, if these smaller nations are not menaced by more powerful, hostile neighbors. But leadership among nations is not always a matter of choice. It is often thrust upon a nation by events over which that nation has no control. Its great wealth, for example, its vast world trade and commerce, its geographic location, or perhaps a sudden new international constellation, or a vacuum which is created in the world by the collapse of another great power, which had held world leadership for a period of time. One or all of these factors may thrust world leadership upon a people which may be either reluctant or unprepared to accept it. Now, our own beloved country has had that leadership thrust upon it in this 20th century, more particularly in the last few decades. Up to the beginning of the 20th century, our country led a fairly isolated political existence. And it more or less prided itself upon its isolation. In that it avoided, by and large, what our people chose to call foreign entanglements. We looked, if not with indifference, certainly with considerable amount of superiority, if not with disdain, upon the endless imperial rivalries of the old world, upon their military alliances, upon their numerous wars. We ourselves somehow felt to be above all that. We lived in a new world, in a different world. Then came the First World War. And reluctantly and unwillingly, we were drawn into it. Drawn into it, we were made to believe, to save the world for democracy. We were interested in democracy. We were the great democratic nation in the world. And we helped win that war. But you may recall from personal reminiscences or from reading of history, if you belong to the younger generation, you may recall that we quickly recoiled after the war from assuming any international obligations or any international commitments. We refused to join the League of Nations, which our own President Wilson formulated, proposed to the world. The isolationist sentiment was very powerful among our people. And that sentiment reduced our role in this international organization, which was created to preserve, maintain peace in the world. That isolationist sentiment reduced our role in that international organization to that of an observer, pure and simple, assuming no responsibilities. And in the long run, this position of ours, this unwillingness to join other nations in assuming direct responsibility for world order, contributed to the disintegration and ultimately to the collapse of the League of Nations. But there were many responsible voices, even at that time, raised to admonish our people that the day of our isolation was at an end, and that however distasteful and regrettable the fact may be, destiny had pushed us into a key position in what was becoming irrevocably one world, and that therefore we must reorient our thinking. We must raise our sights. We must prepare ourselves for new world tasks, for new world responsibilities, that a new era was upon us. In those days, one of the most eloquent voices calling upon America to prepare itself for the new day was that of Mr. Wendell Willkie, you may recall. And he said in those days, it was the end of the First World War. Not a single plane had flown across the Atlantic. Today, the ocean is a mere ribbon with airplanes making regular scheduled flights. The Pacific is only a slightly wider ribbon in the ocean of the air, and Europe and Asia are at our doorstep. America must choose one of three courses after this war. Narrow nationalism, which inevitably means the ultimate loss of our own liberty. International imperialism, which means the sacrifice of some other nation's liberty. Or the creation of a world in which there shall be an equality of opportunity for every race and every nation. I'm convinced, said Mr. Willkie, that the American people will choose by overwhelming majority the last of these three courses. And to make this choice effective, we must win not only the war, but also the peace. And we must start winning it now. And to win this peace, three things seem to be necessary. First, we must plan now for peace on a world basis. Second, the world must be free politically and economically for nations and for men that peace may exist in it. And third, that America must play an active, constructive part in freeing it and keeping its peace. When I say peace must be planned on a world basis, wrote Mr. Willkie, I mean quite literally that it must embrace the earth. Continents and oceans are plainly only parts of a whole, seen as I have seen them from the air. England and America are parts, Russia and China, Egypt, Syria, Turkey, Iraq, and Iran are also parts, and it is inescapable that there can be no peace for any part of the world unless the foundations of peace are made secure throughout all parts of the world. Now, these, of course, are prophetic words spoken quite a number of years ago. But between the First and Second World War, the sentiments of the American people and reflected in the actions of their government were strongly isolationist. And then came the Second World War. And we were again drawn into it. This time to save the world from Nazism and fascism and to establish for all time the principle of national self-determination. And we helped win that war too. But this time, we did not withdraw from any post-war international involvements. In fact, we took the lead in the organization of the United Nations at San Francisco in 1945. And we are today the most active and the most powerful member of this international body for peace. Through the Marshall Plan, we took upon ourselves many heavy financial burdens in an effort to restore the shattered economies of the post-war world. And we are continuing to this day, on the basis of our Point 4 plan, aid, assistance of all kinds, financial and technological, to many of the backward countries of the world. We set about organizing international regional defense pacts against communist aggression We proclaim the Truman Doctrine in relation to Greece and Turkey, you may remember. And more recently, the Eisenhower Doctrine in relation to the Middle East against communist aggression. We went to war in Korea to thwart communist military aggression in that part of the world. We have signed numerous military defense alliances with nations great and small all around the globe. And we have established numerous military bases and airfields and depots in far-flung, far-away strategic places. Most assuredly, we are today not isolated, but enmeshed in the affairs of the whole world and inextricably enmeshed in them. This 20th century is undoubtedly the American century, in the same sense that the 19th century was the century of Great Britain. With this significant difference, Great Britain, throughout the 19th century, at the height of its power and glory, was never confronted, even in the case later on of the powerful empire of the Kaiser, was never confronted with an enemy as powerful, as resourceful, and with an ideology as revolutionary as the United States is challenged today by the Soviet Communist Empire and its allies and its satellites. And so here in Midway, in the 20th century, we find ourselves with the crown and scepter, the privileges, the responsibilities, the worries, the dangers of world leadership. And the question which arises in our minds, naturally, is, are we fit for this historic role of world leadership? Or to be more exact, for the leadership of the free world. And then how are we to lead that world? Are we to lead it alone, solely in our own initiative, or in full consultation and loyal cooperation with our allies? Is this really a job for one great country? Or are we to lead the world through such alliances with other free nations or through the United Nations? Is the United Nations the instrumentality which will enable us to lead the world to peace and order? Can we lead the world without winning and holding the confidence of the free world? Can we lead it without a clear program and a clear policy? These are very disturbing questions, and the answers are not at all simple. At the moment, we must regretfully recognize the fact that we do not have or hold the confidence of the free world. Our strong allies are resentful of us and distrustful of us. They are smarting under grievances. They suspect, rightly or wrongly, they suspect that our government is not quite as idealistic and unselfish in its foreign policies as it would like the world to believe. that our government may be seeking to replace them and their influence in those countries or regions of the earth from which they are being forced to retire, sometimes with the open or covert help and intervention of our own government. They suspect, some of them, some nations among our allies, that the United States is eager for the cooperation of other nations in order to increase its own security and its own defenses and its own interests, rather than the security and the interests of all the free nations of the world. They are particularly baffled and resentful of the frequent fluctuations in our policies and international activities, the sudden reversals, the improvisations, the bold pronouncements and proclamations, and their timid follow-up. All this, they maintain, inhibits them, inhibits their own initiative and action, and frustrates them, and causes them to lose prestige and face, as it were, in the world. And the peoples of the free world, as distinct from their governments, are likewise confused about us and our leadership. We are supposed to be the champions of democracy. We speak of it often, of human rights, the determined enemy of communism, dictatorship, political reaction, the hope of free men. How, they ask themselves, can all this be reconciled with our wooing of the Francos and the Titos, the dictators of the world, signing treaties of friendship with them, providing them with arms, financing them, warmly welcoming rulers of slave-holding states, and arming nations which, in clear violation of their obligations under the United Nations Charter, are preparing by their own profession to use these arms to destroy a free and peace-loving state, also a member of the United Nations. How does the United States government intend to destroy dictatorship by making alliances with dictators and strengthening them in so many parts of the world? The free people of the earth cannot follow the ambiguity, the double talk, which frequently emanate from spokesmen of our State Department, the promises which are made and then are whittled down by legalistic subtleties, the lack of forthright and positive direction given to the world. An instance has occurred within the last few days which may serve to illustrate the point which I am making. You may recall that last Saturday, an oil tanker, Kern Hills, flying the American flag, sailed through the Straits of Tiran and docked at the port of Eilat, carrying oil to the State of Israel. Everybody belonging to the free world, hailed this as the fulfillment of a promise which was made to the State of Israel at the time when it was being urged and coerced to withdraw its troops from that part of the world, from near the Straits of Tiran and from Gaza. Here was an act which heartened the free world and increased the confidence of the free world in the word of our government, of our State Department. But evidently that was not to be the case at all. For shortly thereafter, within a day or so, the State Department spokesman, Mr. Lincoln White, stressed today that the voyage of the United States oil tanker to Eilat was not an official U.S. government-sponsored deliberate test of the Arab blockade. Mr. White said the visit of the freighter should be regarded instead as a logical application of U.S. policy to regard the Gulf as an international waterway. He said the State Department did not get word about the ship until last Friday, when the Israel embassy advised the State Department. The embassy was said to have been informed the United States that the ship would dock on the following day. According to Mr. White, it should be recalled that the ship was under charter of the Israel government. The State Department spokesman quoted Secretary of State Dulles as saying that no ship would be instructed to call at Eilat, but that a U.S. ship might go there in the course of normal commerce. He conceded that the United States could have stopped the Kern Hills, this tanker, if the voyage was felt unwise. Now, if you make any sense out of it, you're pretty good. I failed. I've read this thing four or five times. This is the kind of double talk that confuses and confounds and disturbs not only people who are not citizens of the United States, but loyal and patriotic citizens who expect that their government would speak with a full mouth, clearly, and that it would live up to its promises fully. And yesterday, we read a dispatch from Cairo. It said that the United States is to defer shipping in Aqaba during Suez talk. The United States is reported today to have assured Egypt that no more United States vessels would go to the Israel port of Eilat while the two countries were negotiating on the Suez Canal. Spokesman at the United States Embassy said that they had strict orders not to comment in any way on the subject of American shipping through the Gulf of Aqaba, which leads to Eilat. According to Egyptian and foreign diplomatic sources, the pledge was made by Raymond A. Hare, United States Ambassador, after Egyptian Foreign Ministry had called his attention to Arab displeasure at the passage last Sunday of the American tanker Kern Hill through the Gulf of Eilat. The vessel was carrying the first shipment of oil from Iran to the Israeli Gulf port to be pumped through the new 8-inch pipeline to Beersheba. Now, recently, the Israeli had been urged not to press for their right of free passage through the Suez Canal until the talks were over. And now, seemingly, they are to be content with no ships passing through Aqaba. Until the Suez negotiations are completed. And the likelihood is, of course, that if agreements are reached by the United States with Egypt about the Suez, the right of free passage for Israel shipping will definitely not be included. The preview was already given a few weeks ago by the State Department that the Israeli did not press for free passes through the Suez Canal when they discussed their assumptions, you may recall, with the State Department. So the Israeli were cajoled or coerced to withdraw their forces on the promise that their ships would pass freely through the Gulf of Aqaba, and that the United States would undertake to establish the principle at the earliest moment of free and innocent passage through that strait. And now they are being subjected to the well-known double cross. Members of the State Department do not seem to be so much concerned with the rights of Israel, a small democracy, or for that matter, with the rights of American Jewish citizens. I spoke of that the other day at a meeting here in the city. We have just signed an agreement with Saudi Arabia for an American air base in that country. And we undertook to pay for that right to provide Saudi Arabia with arms which are still denied to the State of Israel, and to train its personnel of army and navy and air forces with American officers, provided no Jew would be included among these American officers. And our government actually put the seal of the United States to that obnoxious and infamous discrimination against free American citizens. And I recall the time, not so very, very long ago, when a president of the United States abrogated a treaty with a powerful Tsarist empire because it discriminated against American Jewish citizens in the matter of honoring American passports. We've gone a long way from that day. In our desire to play a world role and to manipulate the destinies of peoples, without reference to basic principles of right and wrong, without reference to the glorious traditions of America. We are fast coming, I am afraid, to be suspected by many in the free world as a government that does not know its own mind and does not keep its own word. Now, you might be inclined to think that all this tacking and shifting and shuffling and equivocation are part of some profound diplomatic campaign which in the end will yield the desired triumphs for the free world. There are such Americans who actually believe that. There's nothing of the sort. All these tactics which have been going on for some years now have yielded so far only disastrous defeats and setbacks for the free world. The result of our diplomatic artfulness has been, in the first place, to open the Middle East wide open for Russian penetration, a political goal of theirs for centuries, which was never realized until we adopted our own formula for leading the world. Our diplomatic artfulness has resulted in building up Arab intransigence and insolence to strengthen Nasser as the dictator of Egypt and to encourage his dreams of further future conquests. to discredit our allies and cause them to lose prestige, and to endanger the one peace-loving and democratic country in that part of the world. This is not leadership. In these dangerous and dangerously confused times, this is only to make confusion worse confounded. The free world, my friends, needs today a clear and clean and forthright type of leadership. A leadership which upholds human rights and democratic principles like a torch in the night. This small-time diplomatic horse trading, this ruthless oil diplomacy camouflaged as defense of the United Nations and its charter, these clever formulas devised to cover up policies which cannot otherwise be morally justified, this cutting fine legal pirouettes when basic issues are at stake, these are clearly inadequate for the grave emergencies of the hour. What is called for in our leadership of mankind is not only skill, and skill is necessary, and diplomatic dexterity, and that is necessary, but great moral earnestness, massive moral earnestness on the part of those who formulate and execute our foreign policies. Faithful, unswerving adherence to basic principles, not in words. We speak the right words on all occasions, and they're ringing words, not in words, but in action. In the day-by-day execution of foreign policy. This is a war for the mind of the world. It's going to be a long, drawn-out war. Are we, is the free world to win? Is the slave world to win? And this is a war for the minds of the nations as yet uncommitted, of nations who are still coming into the light of a new day. This is a war for the mind of the world. And to win that war, we need the imagination, the enkindling imagination of freedom and liberty and justice and what is right to guide us. We have noble traditions as a people, as a nation. Our life is grounded in a declaration of independence and in a Bill of Rights. And through the years, we have time and again given allegiance by act and a point of great sacrifice to these basic principles of human freedom and human dignity and international justice and of generosity. We are, in a real sense, qualified for that world leadership if the men who are charged with carrying out day by day with the task of translating these ideals in concrete actions and in attitudes, remain loyal to them. We are fit, but people will make us unfit. And if the world loses confidence in us, if the world comes to think that our leadership is no different than the leadership of other empires of the past, who serve their own interest exclusively, regardless, then I'm afraid the world will have no other great nation to turn to for that leadership. And the one other powerful bloc which knows its own mind and is ruthless in its actions will continue to enslave more and more peoples by its beguilements and by pointing to our failures and our mistakes and our weaknesses. We are qualified for world leadership, I believe. The nation of Washington and Jefferson and Franklin and Lincoln. We are qualified for that leadership, but we must keep ourselves fit by constant self-disciplining, by constant checking and rechecking upon what we are doing. We must keep ourselves fit for this great work which God has assigned to this great people.